The coming of love is mysterious as the flight of a bird from unknown lands. The coming of love is mysterious as the flight of a bird from unknown lands. So that is the first line in one of Bhante's poems, one of his long poems, The Veil of Stars, written between 1950 1953, when Bhante was in Kalimpong in India. And if you've got the most recent Complete Works volume of Bhante's poetry, you'll see that it's dedicated to his friend Sachin, who was one of the young men who had come along to the Young Men's Buddhist Association that Bhante founded in Kalimpong. So that's how the poem starts. The coming of love is mysterious as the flight of a bird from unknown lands. And really, everything I'm going to say this morning in the talk is encapsulated in that single line of poetry. Even everything I say, in the four talks that you've just heard are coming, is encapsulated in that single line of poetry. The coming of love is mysterious as the flight of a bird from unknown lands. Even, perhaps we could say, that everything one could say about our theme, the theme of spiritual friendship, is captured in that one single line. I'm not going to say any more about it. Probably won't hear the line again or the poem again. But it strikes me that there's something significant about having that line and that sentiment, I suppose, just hovering above us, hovering in the air while we're here on this spiritual friendship retreat. I know it's an elusive, kind of cryptic way of starting a talk, isn't it, with a single line of poetry and then not saying anything else about it. There's something elusive, something cryptic, something mysterious about the line. But I think that's important to establish right at the outset, because there is something elusive, something cryptic, something mysterious about the topic of spiritual friendship. It's not straightforward. I discovered this when I volunteered to do a series of four talks on spiritual friendship and then started to think about what would I say. I discovered how mysterious, how elusive a subject it actually is. There's a word for that in Buddhism. We've got a ready word, which is handy, isn't it? And the word is guhya. So you'll all be familiar with the word guhya because of Guhyaloka, the secret valley, the secret realm of Guhyaloka. So that's what guhya means, something like secret, something like hidden. And that which is guhya is secret or hidden, not in a superficial sense, not because it's just something we don't talk about. When something is guhya, it's secret or hidden because it's a matter of experience. And experiences are really hard to talk about, really hard to put into words, really hard to communicate. It's easy to talk about ideas. It's easy to talk about concepts. We could do that all day. But to actually describe, to put into words, to communicate one's experience, one's inner experience, the things closest to us, the things that we cherish most deeply, to actually communicate that is a very difficult thing to do indeed. That's why it's guhya, that's why it's secret and hidden. Literally, the word guhya means cave. Bhante translates guhya in his translation of the Dhammapada as the cave of the heart. So that gives us a sense of that word, the cave of the heart. And spiritual friendship is a subject that belongs in the cave of the heart, I think. It is one of these guhya subjects. In a way, it's similar to going for refuge. We've heard that language already. Here you are on a going for refuge retreat. You are going for refuge mitras. We've got all the language, haven't we, around going for refuge. But the real nature of going for refuge is also Guhya. And we're going to see how intertwined, Vidyadharka mentioned it last night, how intertwined and inseparable spiritual friendship and going for refuge actually are. But in terms of going for refuge, some of you will have read Sangharakshita's History of My Going for Refuge, where he tries to trace his own going for refuge, the process as that unfolded in his life, and the way in which he could articulate think about and talk about the process of going for refuge. And he starts that account, he starts the history of my going for refuge with a quote from John Middleton Murray. And I'll just read that quote to you. So John Middleton Murray says, "To discover that within myself which I must obey, to gain some awareness of the law which operates in the organic whole of the internal world, to feel this internal world as an organic whole working out its own destiny according to some vital secret principle, to know which acts and utterances are a liberation from obstacles and an accession to strength, to acknowledge secret loyalties which one cannot deny without impoverishment and starvation. This is to possess one's soul indeed, and it's not easy either to do or to explain." So that's how he begins the history of my going for refuge. We're all going to be giving friendship histories on this retreat. And I think there's something of that flavour of what John Middleton Murray is saying there that also applies to friendship and the history of our friendship. It's like there's an internal world, an organic whole, that we're trying to unfold in our lives. And when you get two people together who are doing that, then you've got something really happening there, haven't you? This working out of destiny in relation to other people according to some vital secret principle. There's something about going for refuge, there's something about spiritual friendship that has this vital secret principle. So Bhante goes on in the history of my going for refuge to describe how it's been an intuitive, an impulsive process for him to get to the point of clarifying that going for refuge is the central and definitive act of the Buddhist life. It's not like he had the idea early on in his life that that was the case. It took a whole life, basically, of practicing the Dharma, studying the Dharma, reflecting deeply, meditating, having flashes of insight to get to that point where he recognized going for refuge is the central and definitive act. And I think if we look at spiritual friendship, which obviously is a big emphasis within our order and movement, it's been a similar process, an intuitive and impulsive process of discovering that spiritual friendship is vital to the spiritual life. So if we go back to Bhante's early years, again in Kalimpong, actually the same time he was writing that poem, The Veil of Stars, the early 50s, he wrote an article then called The Good Friend. The Good Friend. I think it appeared in one of the Buddhist journals that he was either editing or contributing to at the time. And again, it's just come out in the Complete Works, one of the most recent volumes. And in The Good Friend, what Bhante does is he clarifies that friendship is vitally important because it is the emotional equivalent of the doctrine of anatta. So it's the emotional equivalent of the doctrine of no self. So we hear about that a lot, don't we? It's a common teaching. Most people interested in or involved in Buddhism are aware of this doctrine of anatta. But Bhante clarified brought out the fact that, well, you've got to have an emotional equivalent to that. It's no good thinking that you have no self. How does that actually look in your life? And only through friendship and living out unselfishness do we actually have an emotional equivalent to the doctrine of anatta. So even back in the early 50s, this is 70 years ago this year, Bhante was writing articles making the point that spiritual friendship was a key part of the Buddhist life. After that, I mean, when he was in India, he did say himself that even though there were other Buddhists there, people to work with, people to serve the Dharma with, he didn't experience spiritual friendship in the way that we understand it and have come to understand it. He talks about Lama Govinda and his friendship with Lama Govinda in the early 50s, of him finding or discovering what he describes as a kindred spirit, somebody who he did feel like shared his understanding and kind of approach to the Dharma. Actually, just behind Sujana there, that standing rupa of the Buddha, was the gift that Lama Govinda gave to Bhante at their first meeting in person, back again probably 70 years ago in Kalimpong. So it's amazing we've got that. It's just sitting there looking at us every day. But it is a testament to early spiritual friendship in Bhante's life. He also talks about the importance of Dado Rinpoche. Again, we've got the stupa out there with some of Dado Rinpoche's relics. And Dado Rinpoche, one of Bhante's teachers, but also they had this quality in their connection of friendship. Obviously, then Bhante comes back to the UK, the order is founded. In a sense, the order was founded to facilitate, to help strengthen and create new bonds of spiritual friendship. If you read Bhante's memoirs and his description of the coming into being of the order, one of the main reasons is because of the fear of homosexuality that was around in those days and the inhibition that placed on particularly men to become friends with other men. Even if that was seen to be in any way homosexual, that was criticized, put down. It's one of the reasons Bhante decided to found an order, just to blow the lid off that and to really make the point that actually, no, spiritual friendship is key to the spiritual life. And if you've got Buddhist groups and Buddhist societies that put obstacles in the way of people becoming spiritual friends, well, then you can't progress very far on the path. So the founding of our order is a statement of the importance of spiritual friendship. And then, of course, the whole development of the order, how it's grown, the discourse that has entered into the order, the teaching Bhante has given. Again and again, we've heard over the years a gradual emphasis on the importance of spiritual friendship. So that's just a little potted history of spiritual friendship in the order. It's not been clear. It wasn't a clear idea that was then put into action. It's been a process of discovery. It's been a process of exploration, all kinds of twists and turns, no doubt mistakes along the way. But I'm sure all of us in this room would say that we enjoy spiritual friendship as part of our lives as Buddhists in the Tri Ratna Buddhist community. And that is thanks to all that work that's gone on over the years in the past. But the main point I'm making here is that, like going for refuge, what we're dealing with is something elusive, is something quite mysterious, that nevertheless has been brought out, bodied forth in the lives of the order, and in particular in Bhante's life. Even right at the end of Bhante's life, so in 2017, was that a year before Bhante died? 2018? So in 2017, he published an article. If you remember, in the last year or so of his life, he just fired off one article after another on all kinds of themes. But one of the first, if not the first, I can't quite remember, was The Good Friend, The False Friend, and The Spiritual Friend. The Good Friend, The False Friend, and The Spiritual Friend. And in that article, Bhante really repeated several points he'd made over the years, but brought them together. And again, just emphasizing for us the importance of this theme of spiritual friendship. So we had that as recently from Bhante as 2017. So I'm going to, in a way, start where Bhante starts in that article. And he quotes in the first paragraph from the Upada Sutta. You'll all be familiar with this, the Upada Sutta, where Ananda goes to the Buddha. He's been staying in seclusion, reflecting on his own, and he goes to the Buddha to share the reflection that he believes the spiritual life to consist of two things. On the one hand, virya, or striving, and on the other hand, kalyana mitrata, spiritual friendship. So he says, the holy life, I've got it, the holy life consists of these two things. And you all know what the Buddha said. Say not so, Ananda. Say not so. Spiritual friendship is the whole of the spiritual life. Spiritual friendship is the whole of the spiritual life. So I really want to look at that in the talk this morning. And it's by way of introduction. I think it's important before we explore anything else about spiritual friendship, just to really establish what is the significance of spiritual friendship. And that statement from the Buddha is quite something, isn't it? Spiritual friendship is the whole of the spiritual life. You couldn't get a more significant declaration, could you, than that? You couldn't get the significance of spiritual friendship put in more clear, more vivid, more striking terms than that. It's the whole of the spiritual life. So that is what we're going to explore today. Why? Why is spiritual friendship the whole of the spiritual life? And brace yourselves, because this is going to be one question after another, which I'm going to attempt to explore myself. They're not questions that I expect answers from the floor, so to speak, to come. But I think this is how we've got to do it. It's really to plumb the depths of that statement. We have to ask questions. We have to question that deeply. So spiritual friendship is the whole of the spiritual life. Well, the first question that occurs to me is, well, what is the spiritual life? If spiritual friendship is the whole of it, well, what is the spiritual life? So that's a translation, obviously. So spiritual life is a translation into English of the Pali word that appears in the Upada Sutta, Brahmacharya. So spiritual friendship is the whole of the Brahmacharya. So usually we assume Brahmacharya to mean celibacy. So the complete abstention from all kinds of sexual activity. Actually, it's got a much richer meaning than that. So Brahmacharya, the kind of accepted translation of that, has become the holy life. Bhante prefers the divine life. He says it's more theologically neutral. So Brahmacharya is the divine life. And in the article, one of the things Bhante draws out is that the Buddha's talking about the Brahmacharya. He's talking about the divine life. But he goes on to tell Ananda that with spiritual friendship, it's to be expected that one will cultivate the Eightfold Path. So with spiritual friendship, it's to be expected, it's natural, that one would follow the Eightfold Path. So he makes the point that in actual fact, the Brahmacharya here is synonymous with the Eightfold Path. So one who follows the Brahmacharya is a follower of the Eightfold Path. So in a sense, when we talk about Brahmacharya, in this context, the divine life, we're talking about the Buddhist life. The life that is following the Buddhist path, whether that's the Eightfold Path, Threefold Path, Six Paramitas, however we want to describe it, that which is the Buddhist life, the follower of the Buddhist path. What does that mean? That's the next question. What does it mean to be following the Buddhist path? What does it mean to be a Buddhist? Well, we've already heard, haven't we, that going for refuge is the central and definitive act of the Buddhist life. So what defines one as a Buddhist is going for refuge. So we can use that language. So spiritual friendship is the whole of the going for refuge. We could put it like that, couldn't we? Next question. What is going for refuge? Well, there's different ways we could approach that, aren't there? But going for refuge implies a going for refuge from something to something. So we've got to explore that. I was speaking to somebody recently, a Mitra in Berlin, a friend, who was saying that For him, when he first came along, people were using this language of going for refuge, and he found it all very strange. Going for refuge was not the kind of language he'd heard on the streets of Berlin up until that point, but he stepped into the Buddhist center and people were saying it all the time, going for refuge. So it is a bit strange, isn't it, when we stop and reflect on it. It's not common language. But nevertheless, it is a really adequate, appropriate and poetic way of describing the human situation. The existential situation in which we find ourselves as human beings. The language of going for refuge really connects directly to that. It's the traditional term, of course, that we find in the Pali Canon. People going for refuge to the Buddha, the Dharma and the Sangha. But the reason that language so adequately captures what it is to be human, the human existential situation, is because life is a search for refuge. Life is a search for refuge. You know, we're all born into this life. I was going to say without asking for it, but actually perhaps we do ask for it if we take rebirth into account and all the rest of it. But we're born into this life and it's insecure. We're born into an insecure life. And we can't help as human beings but search for security, seek security. Whether we're fully conscious of it or not, deep down we are, that things are changing, things are unstable, that which we rest upon will shift and move and disappear. We are aware of that on some level. So life is a search for some kind of security, something to hold on to, some kind of refuge given that existential situation. So life then is a search for refuge. And of course, we all know this. It will come out, no doubt, in our friendship histories. We tend to look in the wrong place. We tend to seek security, seek refuge in things that can't actually adequately offer security or refuge. It might be that, you know, we think of that in terms of dukkha and pain in quite explicit ways. You know, we're experiencing all kinds of pain and discomfort in life, and so we're seeking a refuge. It might be that we're just seeking a refuge from triviality, from banality, meaninglessness. I was reading Bhante's memoirs, The Rainbow Road, the first volume recently. He describes going to an army ball, an army dance. I think it's in Darjeeling. And he's just watching people dance, and he's got vivid descriptions, as he often has, in his memoirs of army men in the uniforms, women in the long dresses and painted lips and painted faces, makeup on, twirling round and having fun. And he just doesn't see, he just thinks it's a bit of a horror show. I don't think he puts it quite like that, but he talks about people jerking around spasmodically like puppets. And he just can't see the meaning in it. It's not that he's down on dancing particularly, or people having fun, but if that's the pinnacle of your life, if that's where you're looking for refuge, well, it's just empty of meaning, it's devoid of meaning. And it's one of the precursors to him really deciding to go forth and to pursue, the divine life, the brahmacharya, the going for refuge. So we're all seeking to get away from something, aren't we? Dukkha, pain, meaninglessness, triviality. And with the language of going for refuge, we've also got a sense of moving towards something that does offer that security. I know this is very familiar ground, but we've got to establish it to have any chance of understanding spiritual friendship. So we go for refuge to the Buddha, the Dharma and the Sangha, the three jewels, as symbolizing that which does have meaning, that which does offer a true refuge and does offer security given our human existential situation. Last question, or three questions in one. If going for refuge to the three jewels is the spiritual life, well, what are the three jewels? Who is the Buddha? What is the Dharma? What is the Sangha? We've got to ask those questions. We can't really get any deeper than that, can we? We're getting into something now. Who is the Buddha? What is the Dharma? And what is the Sangha? So simply put, well, the Buddha is the human being, the teacher who discovered the way to enlightenment and began to teach it. The Dharma is that teaching, the formulation into communication, expression of the Buddha's enlightenment, of his realization. The Sangha is the fellowship, the community of those gathering around the Buddha and his Dharma. That's one way of answering the question, isn't it? But surely it goes a lot deeper than that. Who is the Buddha? Well, we can see, he was the historical human being, Siddhartha Gautama, who discovered the way to Nirvana. But if we start to explore, well, what is Nirvana, then the whole question of who the Buddha is gets taken to another level entirely, doesn't it? So the Buddha himself talked about his realization in different ways. Often it's said the Buddha didn't say much about Nirvana, but actually he did. He did say things about Nirvana, but what he said was always suggestive, always symbolic, never concrete. So things like, well, Nirvana is the deathless. In the Arya Pariyesana Sutta, he says he discovered that which was unaging, unailing. How else does he describe it? Well, he uses the deathless in that particular sutta. Not subject to change, etc., etc., etc. So we get all these metaphors to try to capture what it is the Buddha discovered. We even get images. Nirvana is the cool cave. Nirvana is the holy city. Nirvana is the further shore. But doesn't tell us what it is. Again, it's guhya. You can't adequately put that into words. So when we ask the question, who is the Buddha, we've got the historical person, but the actual realization is something unfathomable. It's something ineffable, indefinable, indescribable. Something we can only realize for ourselves to have any clue what it's about. I won't go on, but it's the same for the Dharma, it's the same for the Sangha, isn't it? The Dharma is not just the teaching, it's not just the words, it's not just the books that we have. You know, according to the Mahayana, it's the universal law streaming down all the time, communicating all the time. You know, you could write 1,000 new sutras today because the Dharma, in essence, as a universal law, as a principle, is pouring down all the time. And the same with the Sangha, it's not just a group of people. You've got the whole hierarchy, haven't you, of being. So the Aryas, those who've attained stream entry and beyond, but you've got the whole Bodhisattva hierarchy. You've got Buddhas in other world systems according to Buddhist cosmology. So in asking what is the Sangha again, we're into cosmic territory. We're into the ineffable, into the indefinable, the indescribable. So, there we go. The going for refuge to the three jewels is of that nature. It's of that depth and that profundity. Just so we're not discouraged, because we are here on a going for refuge retreat, and that's putting the goal really high, isn't it? That's really setting the bar high. We are in touch with that. We do have some connection with the three jewels, even in the highest aspect, even if we're not aware of that, they must, if the universal principles, so to speak, the Buddha principle, the Dharma principle, the Sangha principle, must be having an influence on us, must be there to some extent in our experience. And I think this is why it's really significant that Bhante has spoken in terms of levels of going for refuge. So going for refuge is a whole process, a whole sweep. From where we are now, unenlightened human beings, all the way to enlightenment. So we get those levels, don't we? I'll just quickly run through them. So we get the cultural going for refuge. Perhaps we believe, or others believe, that they're born Buddhists. So you're Buddhists just by virtue of birth. or for us perhaps, because that's unlikely, the cultural going for refuge would just be going through the motions without actually having any impulse to progress on the path at all. There's a cultural going for refuge. Then there's the provisional going for refuge. So this is where we have some inkling of the path, some inkling of what we're moving towards, aspiration to do that, but we're still trying to work out what that actually means, how to do it, whether we want to do it. So there's a provisional dimension or provisional nature to going for refuge. Then we've got effective going for refuge. So effective going for refuge is the point of commitment to the path, the point of commitment to that whole sweep and process of going for refuge. It's knowing what conditions one needs to have in place to continue making progress. After that comes real going for refuge. So real going for refuge is the point of irreversibility. So this is synonymous with stream entry. Synonymous with stream entry. It's no longer, there's no question anymore of falling back. There's just a progressive movement in the direction, let's say, of the transcendental. The gravitational pull of the transcendental has got us and is pulling us. Doesn't mean we stop doing anything or stop making an effort, but there's that sweep until we get the ultimate going for refuge, which is when you become the refuge yourself. This is Buddhahood. The ultimate going for refuge is Buddhahood itself. There's another kind of level which Bhante talks about. It's not quite a level. He says this might sound, this is again in the history of my going for refuge and elsewhere, might sound impossibly poetic, but there's a kind of cosmic going for refuge. If one looks at the universe, what one sees is all phenomena trying to transcend what they currently are. And in that sense, the entire cosmos could be seen in terms of going for refuge. So don't take that literally, he's being poetic, but we could speak of the cosmos going for refuge, that impulse, that search for refuge, for security. You can see that in life. You can see that as the kind of essence. You can see that as the vital secret principle in all life. Life is growing, living, developing, evolving. The cosmos is going for refuge, we could say poetically. Okay, so that's the end of that little inquiry. So where have we got the spiritual life in the Apada Sutta? Is the brahmacharya, the divine life, the follower of the Buddhist path. We can talk about that in terms of going for refuge. We can talk about that in terms of the levels of going for refuge. We can talk about that even as the whole cosmos going for refuge. And the whole of that is spiritual friendship. The whole of the cosmos going for refuge and all that that entails, the profundity of it, the mystery of it, and yet the appearance of it, the almost tangibility of it, the whole of the spiritual life, the whole of the going for refuge is spiritual friendship. So if we thought that was quite a statement 10 minutes ago, it feels like even more of a statement now, doesn't it? So how on earth is the whole of that spiritual friendship? Why would the Buddha say that the whole of the spiritual life is spiritual friendship? We might even object. It might seem strange to us that he says the whole of that process is spiritual friendship. It might seem strange as opposed to, well, meditation or ethical purity or study of the scriptures, worship of the Buddhas. Maybe we could accept that as being the whole of the spiritual life. But spiritual friendship, does that sound right? We might even object more strongly, well, the Buddha didn't seem to have spiritual friends, all of the time at least. The Buddha was not sat with his spiritual friend under the Bodhi tree at Bodh Gaya when he gained enlightenment. So in his case, he didn't seem to need spiritual friends. So what's going on there? I don't think that's quite true. I think there were aspects in the Buddha's life of spiritual friendship, and we'll see that perhaps tomorrow more fully. But nevertheless, we would be right, I think, to question this statement that the whole of the spiritual life is spiritual friendship. But that's what the Buddha said. That is the Buddhavacca. It's the word of the Buddha. It's the Amitavacca, the deathless speech of the Buddha. Spiritual friendship is the whole of the spiritual life. So let's explore a bit further. And next we need to ask the question, well, what is spiritual friendship? We've done one side of the equation. Well, what is spiritual friendship? Can that help us explore this in a bit more depth? So spiritual friendship in the Upada Sutta, we've heard it's the whole of the spiritual life, the Brahmacharya. The translation of spiritual friendship is Kalyana Mitrata. Again, familiar ground. You'll all be familiar with the term and its translation. Mitrata is friendship, and Kalyana is, like Vidyadhaka said last night, could be translated as beautiful, auspicious, morally good, noble, helpful, all of these words, very rich word, very beautiful word. So Kalyana Mitrata then is beautiful friendship, noble friendship, the friendship that is morally good, auspicious friendship. So there we go, there's a definition, it tells us something. But it's easy to hear that, to take those words, those definitions, and to assume we know what it is. So we can relate to beauty, we can relate to helpfulness, we can even relate to that which is auspicious. But let's be really clear, we're not talking about friendship on a mundane level when we talk about Kalyana Mitrata. And it's important to make the distinction that Bhante makes in this article in 2017 between the good friend and the spiritual friend. He's actually drawing, I think, on the Sigalavada Sutta there, where the Buddha makes that same distinction, the spiritual friend and the good friend. So the good friend, let's hope we've all got them. Good friends are great because good friends are loyal. Good friends keep their promises. Good friends look after us when we're sick. They care for our property. Good friends are great. Good friends, it said, will even risk their lives for you. They'll even surrender their lives for you. And good friends can show us all the way to heaven. So in traditional Buddhist cosmology, we've got all these deva realms, beautifully laid out in things, in iconography, in descriptions. A good friend can help us to access higher and higher states of consciousness within the realm of the devas, let's say. But only a spiritual friend can take us beyond that. So as good as good friendship is, only a spiritual friend can take us beyond the mundane. Only a spiritual friend can show us the way to enlightenment, can point that out to us, can point us in that direction, that right direction. So spiritual friendship is not to be reduced to or limited to the mundane. It breaks out of the mundane, if you like. Spiritual friendship is a breaking out of the world into, we can't put it into words, we've already said, it's indefinable, it's ineffable, indescribable. So this is why Bhante has said of the Buddha that he's the original spiritual friend. So because the Buddha discovers the way to enlightenment, spiritual friendship is born with the Buddha's discovery of enlightenment. Actually, it's a rediscovery, isn't it? So again, referring to Buddhist cosmology, it's said that the Dharma appears in the world when a Buddha gains enlightenment, teaches, and over time that teaching does degenerate and does even disappear. Aeons pass, like incalculable amounts of time pass, and when conditions are ripe, another Buddha arises and rediscovers the Dharma. So with the Buddha in our world system, in our world period, he rediscovers the way to Nirvana. And when he does, that's when spiritual friendship becomes possible. Until there's the discovery of the Dharma, until the Buddha's Nirvana, no spiritual friendship. There's no one in the world capable of offering spiritual friendship. So the Buddha is the original Kalyana Mitra. The Buddha is the original spiritual friend. So hopefully this is starting to give us more of a feel of, again, the profundity and depth of spiritual friendship. It's born into the world with the Buddha's enlightenment. And just to really get a feel for that, let's look at the Buddha's enlightenment and the emergence in the world of the Buddha. And we'll start to see some of the qualities of spiritual friendship are glimmering there. And we'll see how, in actual fact, not just the emergence of the Buddha, but the emergence of the three jewels in the world, the Dharma and the Sangha as well, are an unfolding of spiritual friendship. So if the Buddha is the original spiritual friend, and it comes with him, the capacity for spiritual friendship, the Dharma is a further unfolding of that, and the Sangha is a further unfolding of that. So let's start with the Buddha then, with the original spiritual friend. And the Buddha's description of his enlightenment in the Arya Pariyasana Sutta is particularly important, I think, particularly interesting to us. So he discovers the Dharma, and we're told that he begins to reflect. What's going on in the Buddha's mind is impossible for us to know, of course, but the text tells us that there's something going on, and it's expressed in this reflection that the Dharma that he's realized is hard to see, hard to understand. It's not to be understood by mere reasoning, by mere thinking. It's not to be understood conceptually. It's too subtle, too deep. So he's reflecting in that way, and he sees that in the world there is too much attachment. There's so much attachment, delighting in attachment, an inability to relinquish attachment, that we're told he begins to favour inaction. So his mind tends towards inaction, not to sharing. Sometimes that's taken to mean the Buddha's kind of not that interested, or as if the Buddha's making some kind of decision in the way that we might make a decision about what we're going to have for dinner, or, you know, what clothes we're going to wear. Shall I teach? I can't conceive of it possibly have been like that. It must have been something much deeper and more profound than that that's going on. The way I read it is that the very fact that this is crossing the Buddha's mind, so to speak, that this is occurring in the enlightened mind at all, shows that there's a compulsion to do it. That's how I read it. Surely there's a compulsion to do it because this is an issue. It's more like there's that compulsion and that's so strong, and then there's also the recognition of the sublimity, the beauty, the profundity and depth of the Buddha's realization, that the two things are coming into a kind of tension, if we can speak of tension in the mind of a Buddha. This is all interpretation, of course, but it's like there's some kind of friction, tension between the beauty, the sublimity, and the desire to share it, and seeing that the world is, in a way, perhaps incapable, possibly incapable of actually understanding. So you get that kind of tension going on. And then the text tells us that Brahma Sahampati, the lord of a thousand worlds, becomes aware of what's occurring in the mind of the Buddha. So becomes aware of that kind of trembling, and he appears. And he pleads with the Buddha to teach the Dharma. He says there are beings wasting through not having heard the Dharma. There are beings with little dust on their eyes. If they were to hear the Dharma, some would understand it. Some would understand it. Now, how do we take that? Do we take it literally that a Brahma appeared before the Buddha? Do we take it as symbolic of the process that the Buddha was himself experiencing? I don't know. Who knows? What was going on in the Buddha's mind. But what it says to me is that What we've got here in this moment of tension in the mind of the Buddha is, again, a compulsion. It gives us further reinforcement that there was this compulsion to share, to go forth. We could call it love and compassion. That desire, that compulsion to share is the Buddha's love and compassion. It's unfathomable to us what the Buddha's love and compassion consist in. It's probably unimaginable to us what the compassion of the Lord of a thousand worlds, Brahma Sahampati's compassion was. But at least we can relate to that because it's in the world, so to speak. Whereas the Buddha's compassion is beyond that. But maybe with the appearance of Brahma Sahampati, we've got some inclination of the depth and profundity of the Buddha's love and compassion. And then he has the vision, doesn't he? So he has the vision of the world of beings as being like lotuses in different stages of development. So he's seeing the potential in beings for the realization of nirvana. So some are submerged in the water, some are just coming out of the water, some are opening and coming into full bloom. So he sees the potential in every single being for awakening. And that's when he makes this great declaration, wide open are the doors of the deathless. Let those who have ears release their faith. In one of the translations, wide open are the doors of the deathless. Let those who hear release their faith. And with that, Brahma Sahampati knows mission accomplished. The Buddha's going forth, the Buddha will communicate, and he disappears, and the Buddha does go forth. So maybe this gives us more of a vivid sense or picture, an example of the emergence of spiritual friendship. The Buddha as the original spiritual friend. He's the original spiritual friend because of that compulsion to love. He's the original spiritual friend because he sees the full potential in others. Not just their potential to improve themselves, not just their potential to become a bit happier, but their potential to become fully and perfectly enlightened themselves. He sees that, and that's how he's relating to the world. So a spiritual friend can do that. A spiritual friend sees that potential, guides you in the direction of that potential. So then, moving swiftly on, because I'm running out of time, we get the emergence as well of the Dharma and the Sangha. So you all know the story. I don't need to go into it in great depth, but the Buddha goes to his five former good friends in the deer park at Isipatana, and he begins to communicate to them. He begins to share with them what has happened. And sometimes descriptions of that or depictions of that can seem a bit cold, can't they? And, you know, there's the dynamic of the teacher and the student and something aloof. But we can't think of it only in those terms. It must have been more human than that. There must have been more warmth in the communication than that. This is, if you like, the unfolding of spiritual friendship, because it's the Buddha offering his five companions an invitation into the Dharma themselves. So one of the things that we chant in the Thi Ratnavandana every morning is Ehi Passiko, come and see. The Dharma is an invitation. So the Buddha, as the original spiritual friend, invites, with the emergence of the Dharma, invites others into his discovery, into his realization. And they take up the invitation, don't they? So again, you all know the story. At some point in the communication that's going on, the responsiveness of the five friends, Kondanya, he understands. And the Buddha declares, Kondanya knows. Kondanya knows. So he gains stream entry at that point. His Dharma eye opens, and then the other four, likewise, in turn, the same thing happens to them. So out of the original spiritual friend comes the Dharma, the communication, the invitation. And as his friends start to cotton on, start to realize for themselves, well, then we're getting the creation of the Sangha. And again, I think we can see the emergence of the Sangha in terms of spiritual friendship. It's a further unfolding of spiritual friendship. Because what comes next, the Buddha gives the so-called second discourse. Curiously enough, it's the discourse on the not-self characteristic. He goes through the five skandhas. He demonstrates to them that there's nothing permanent to be found in the five skandhas. And often that teaching is taken as a subjective analysis of one's lack of an essential permanent self. But imagine it. You've got the Buddha there. You've got five stream entrants there. They're exploring the five skandhas in that kind of depth. I don't know why, but to me this is a dark night with a fire and stars above them, and they're all around it, and they're all exploring this stuff. And they all, one by one, understand. They all see, and they all gain arahantship. So you've got six arahants, let's say, sat around the fire, completely aware of the nature of reality, of, let's say, the cosmic going for refuge. There's nothing in the way anymore in terms of any vestige of clinging on to something that they think is a permanent identity in themselves. But it's not that they just disappear, is it? The whole scene is not just swallowed up into a black hole. If we were not a fly on the wall, but if we were there and witnessing that, we would still see six men sat round a fire. And they would have seen something. Like, who knows what they were perceiving, but there was something going on. It's like all the veils drop. And surely that is spiritual friendship taken to the absolute utmost degree, if we can talk of spiritual friendship in even having a ceiling. It's just fully seeing another human being and then being able to fully see you without any obstruction, without any veil whatsoever. I mean, that's spiritual friendship, isn't it? That is spiritual friendship fully unfolded in the world. So what we've got with the creation of the Sangha is a lineage of Kalyana Mitrata, a lineage of spiritual friendship. So we've gone from one man, the original spiritual friend, the Dharma, the invitation, and then to the Sangha and the creation of a lineage of spiritual friendship. And that has flowed right down through the generations. And again, in case anyone's thinking I'm a terrible spiritual friend because I'm nowhere near that level, well, we are in touch with it because we're part of that lineage of Kalyana Mitrata, of spiritual friendship. Okay, so we're just about running out of time. I'm going to keep pushing. Sorry to the servers and the cooks, we'll just have to deal with that and have a slightly later lunch. Hopefully it's worth it. So that's by way of introduction to the series, and we're going to explore the three jewels over the next 3 days in more depth and look at how each of the three jewels relates to spiritual friendship in more detail, and we'll draw out more practical points for ourselves and our own practice of spiritual friendship. I just want to conclude with four observations. And these are more practical points, and we'll probably produce the main points for discussion in the groups tomorrow. So we've seen that spiritual friendship is the whole of the spiritual life. We could recast that as the whole of the going for refuge. So spiritual friendship, in a sense, is inseparable from going for refuge. The two are virtually synonymous. We're talking about the same process, spiritual friendship and going for refuge. And I said right at the beginning of the talk that in a way we have language, we have a discourse, we have a body of teaching on spiritual friendship, but it's not really worked out and systematized. Likewise with going for refuge, we have perhaps more of a systematization, more of a discourse on going for refuge. But drawing on that, I think there are things we say about going for refuge that we can also say, or at least explore, more in terms of spiritual friendship. So that's my suggestion for our groups tomorrow, is to look at the things we say about going for refuge and how they relate directly to spiritual friendship. So I've got four suggestions. So the first one is, we often say this, you'll often have heard this, going for refuge needs to be at the centre of our mandala. So we, in asking for ordination, you've all declared your aspiration to place going for refuge at the centre of your mandala, and all of your life will be reorganised around going for refuge at the centre of your mandala. So, what about spiritual friendship is at the centre of our mandala? Or we aspire to put spiritual friendship at the centre of our mandala, because the two things are virtually synonymous. We need to put spiritual friendship at the centre of our mandala, and that will bring about a radical reorganisation of our lives. So to what extent are we doing that? To what extent are we placing spiritual friendship at the centre of our lives, at the centre of our network of human relationships, as Bhante's referred to it? What effect is it having on us, having spiritual friendship more and more to the centre of our lives? How is that changing our lives? So that's the first thing. The second thing that you've probably heard, and you'll have seen this in the Ten Pillars if you've studied that, if you've read that, going for refuge is one's life's blood as a Buddhist. Or maybe Bhante says as an order member, because he's talking to the order. Going for refuge is one's life blood as an order member. And the practice of the precepts is the circulation of that blood. So if we're not practicing the ten precepts, the going for refuge will eventually wither and die. That's how Bhante puts it, or words to that effect. So again, what about spiritual friendship? So spiritual friendship is one's life's blood as an order member. And then it brings in the whole question of how we practice the precepts. So we're practicing the precepts to activate our going for refuge, but what about seeing that in relation to spiritual friendship? Do we see our ethical life as being lived out primarily in the context of spiritual friendship? So is our practice of ethics taking place within the context of spiritual friendship? Because it's easy to think of, say, practicing the first precept of love in abstract terms of towards all beings. But are we actually practicing the first precept in relation to our spiritual friends? We can have all kinds of concerns for things like the environment, for political issues and campaigns. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that. Maybe those things are all well and good. But if we're ignoring the people closest to us, if we're ignoring our spiritual friends and not practicing the precepts in relation to them, well, I think there's an issue there. So to what extent do we see spiritual friendship as the arena for our ethical practice, as the principal arena for our ethical practice? Okay, third one is... we speak of going for refuge as, or not talking in terms of criteria. So going for refuge is not quantifiable. It's not a tick box exercise, to clarify whether or not we're going for refuge. So the application of criteria doesn't really work. Might be useful. Last year, I'm aware that the Preceptors College released 8 guidelines, and they're guidelines. So we're not to take them literally. It's not that if you do these 8 things, you're ready to be ordained, or if you're doing these 8 things, you're a great order member. You can't reduce going for refuge to a neat list of 8 points. That's not a criticism, by the way, of the 8 guidelines. It's a criticism of the human tendency to take things literally. So don't take that literally in relation to going for refuge. But we can say exactly the same for spiritual friendship. You can't reduce spiritual friendship to a list of criteria. Don't think that because you meet this friend every month or speak to them on the phone at this time every month that you're doing spiritual friendship. Spiritual friendship is a living thing. It's an organic thing. It's something that grows between 2 or more people. So you can't reduce that to a list. So maybe that's a point for discussion. Okay, and last point, I'm going to have to condense this one, I think, but we talk about levels of going for refuge. Can we talk about levels of spiritual friendship? And again, literalism alert. Don't start thinking of yourself as a provisional spiritual friend or an effective provisional, or worse, thinking of other people as, well, he's just a provisional friend, I'm an effective spiritual friend. That's not what I'm saying. But it might be useful just to think of that model and relate it to spiritual friendship, because of the importance of conditions in friendship. So a spiritual friendship is only effective to the point that we put conditions in place to make it effective. And if that's true, if the conditions are not in place, well, effective spiritual friendship could become provisional, it could become cultural. We could be meeting for coffee with our so-called spiritual friend, talking about football, talking about the news, never talking about going for refuge. That's not spiritual friendship, because it's got nothing to do with going for refuge. So maybe that's a point for discussion too. Can we think of spiritual friendship in terms of effectiveness? And even, let's just leave it there, because it's almost time for lunch. But there we go, four talking points. But I hope the main point has come across, that what we're dealing with here is an elusive, mysterious subject, as elusive as going for refuge to the three jewels itself. And we'll explore that to the extent we can. We'll hover around that, we'll circle around that for the following three mornings. Okay, thank you.